The 920 KVEC Podcast Network is presented by the Slo County Real Estate Podcast with Hal Swayze. Up-to-date information on the local real estate market on your time. New episodes weekly at the podcast link at 920kvec.com and wherever you get your podcasts. California DRE 01111911.
Five oh seven on the Central Coast. It's Monday, March 4th, 2024. I'm Dave Congleton. In about an hour, we'll offer you a conversation with the sheriff of Riverside County, Chad Bianco. Yes, he is running for governor, but that's a side issue to the conversation. Tomorrow, we wade back into the parking issue. Joe Benson has an interesting op-ed piece at Cal Coast News, and we want to compare what's happening in San Luis to what's happening up in Paso Robles. We got a lot to cover this week. Just stay with us throughout the week. The Dave Congleton Show. We are your hometown radio talk show. But this hour, no politics. Nothing overly controversial. The Oscars are Sunday. Bill Ostrander is back with us, a well-known local political activist. But Bill is also a working actor and has been a working actor for decades. And we decided that we wanted to spend some time reminding people about Hollywood, specifically in the decade of the 1980s, and how much what we see in movies today is shaped by that decade. Why am I talking when Bill Ostrander is back?
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
How are you, sir? I was watching you today. What's with the sideburns and Christine?
Well... You know, because the character of Buddy Ruperton, who I played, the bad guy in there, was one of those guys that we all knew in high school who was held back a couple years.
Yep.
He was the guy who looked like, you know, he was shaving as a freshman, you know?
Yeah.
And there was a guy that I modeled that character after in my school, and his name was Bill Porter. And Bill Porter had those kind of mutton chop sideburns, so I grew them specifically for that.
Does he know the story?
I don't know. I've never talked to Bill since high school.
All right.
I mean, he might now because I think a few people, have known about that and may have talked to him from back home in Indiana.
You and I both came out here from the Midwest. You came out about 10 years earlier, though. You came out in 1978.
Well, indirectly, yes. Yeah. I came through Seattle. I lived there about 6 months, and then I came down to Hollywood in October of 78. And I got a film the first week I was here.
How'd you make the decision to come to Hollywood?
You know, I grew up on the farm, and I really thought that I wanted to be in farming, but it didn't work out for me in that direction. So I had seen Smokey and the Bandit and thought, man, I'd like to live like Burt Reynolds. And I thought, well, why not? So I took off, and I thought, you know, you have to understand the Midwest. I mean, you come from Indiana too, so you know that people don't like people that stand out. They don't like, you're supposed to blend in. You're supposed to work long hours.
Don't call attention to yourself.
Exactly.
Yep.
So for me to sort of announce as this farm boy from Indiana, you know, star green hand in FFA that I was going to go be an actor was just a bridge too far. So I used to tell people that I was going to be a stuntman.
Oh, okay.
And so about 2 hours after I left home, I don't know, for whatever reason, I got to about the Illinois border and I thought, you know, I really think it would be fun to be an actor. And so that's what I did. So I went to Seattle, lived there for about 6 months, and then I came down to Los Angeles.
And you got a booking within the first week?
I did.
Did you have an agent?
No.
How'd you get the first booking?
Well, there's some preface to all of this, if you don't mind me telling it. All right. So I came down. I had $150. That's all I had. I had an old 1974 Pinto station wagon that was blowing smoke like it burned coal for a fuel. And it had a door that was sort of bent open from this guy who had used my car and damaged it, but didn't have any money to pay for it. I drove all night long to get down to Los Angeles from Seattle because I couldn't afford a hotel. And my game plan was I had like $150 that I could get an apartment for the first month and I'll work at McDonald's. That was my plan.
On $150.
On $150. Wow. Yeah. I didn't say this was well thought out. Yeah. I just said it was my plan.
Yeah.
So I came down and I was sleeping in my car in Westwood, and I happened to pick up a newspaper and said that there was a hotel room that was for rent in Beverly Hills for $15 a night. And I was like, I haven't had a shower in a while now. And I was cleaning myself in a gas station sink and eating cold soup out of a, you know, that Dinty Moore or whatever things were, right?
Yeah.
And I went and I went to this hotel and I came to the door and I, or the desk, and I said, hi, I'd like to have that room for $15 a night. And she said, oh, I'm sorry, we're all booked up. I said, no, you can't be. I mean, I was desperate for that room, right? Yeah. She said, well, I'm sorry, honey, but we're all booked up. And I said, but it says in the paper, you know, I was so insistent, right? So this lady, she said, hold on a second. And she turned and looked down the hallway and she said something, called her son's name, turned out to be a guy who was her son, said, when's the last time we've seen so-and-so? And he said, like 3 weeks. She said, so honey, this is what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to rent you his room. He's been staying here for about the last year, but if he hasn't been here for like 3 weeks. If he shows up, I'm going to have to ask you to leave. If he doesn't show up, you can have his room that night. So I said, okay, deal, you know. Yeah. And she asked her son to go help me, or to go set up this room. So he says to me, you want to come with? So I said, sure. And he's a kid about my age, black kid about my age. Get to the door, and he's telling me how much I look like John Travolta.
Yeah.
Because back then, Saturday Night Fever just came out, and I had the hair like Tony Manero and all that stuff.
Yeah, you did.
I go to the door, and he's standing here telling me how much I look like Tony Manero or John Travolta, opens the door, and the inside of this hotel room looks like a shrine to John Travolta.
Oh, dear.
The guy that was there had put up posters over all the walls. He had fan magazines and you name it. And amongst others was a drama log. And if you remember back then, they used to put out a paper called the Drama Log, which is a paper, sort of a newspaper that was meant specifically for actors. And in it, they had an advertisement for actors, 18 to 25-year-old New York-looking ethnic types. I'd never even been to New York before, right? But I thought, well, this is why I'm here. Yeah. I might as well go on it, right? Yeah. So it was a Saturday, which is an unusual day for casting. And I went to the address. I was a little bit late because I was kind of unsure of myself. Just a hallway full of dudes that looked like me, right? And I thought, oh, I mean, it probably two-thirds of them were from New York. And I was this farm boy, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so they called me in and they said, you know, what's your name? So I started talking like I was from New York.
Yeah.
So William Ostrander, you know. And I was the first person they picked. And it was a film... starring Joey Travolta, and for the first 3 weeks, half the crew thought I was Joey.
But what did Joey say when he saw you?
He actually is a really great guy, and I got to know him a little bit after the film. I didn't really talk to him much during the film, but after the film, he turned out to be a really cool guy.
But
really
he didn't notice the resemblance to his brother?
He never said anything to me, but you know how oftentimes when you're doing a movie that they cordon off, you know, public from the movie set, right?
Yeah.
And I would be walking from like the set to my trailer or something like that, and people would start cheering and waving and stuff like that, and I just wave.
Welcome to Hollywood.
Yeah.
All right, Bill Ostrander is with us for the hour. We're just looking at Hollywood specifically during the 1980s. We'll pick up the conversation as we get ready for the Oscars later this week. We're live, we're local, we're hometown. Oscars are Sunday. We're not going to talk specifically about the Oscars, but Bill Ostrander and I want to focus specifically on the decade of the 1980s. And Bill, I think it's a broad question, but we should remind folks about how filmmaking radically changed between the 70s and the 80s. Whole different world.
Right. You know, it started, the change started with independent films in the early 70s. And there was a tremendous number of really, really, really good independent films.
Yep.
And then Jaws came along and introduced what we know today as the blockbuster.
Yep.
That changed all kinds of things. The math usually when it comes to investing in a film is out of 10 films, 6 of them tend to lose money. 2 of them can break even, 1 of them makes money, and 1 of them makes a lot of money. And so when an investor comes in to invest in something that has a very low percentage chance of having a big return, they try to stack the deck with whatever they can, with whether it's actors or whether it's a storyline or whether it's a concept. So what we saw with Star Wars, which was, you know, the highest grossing sequel, I think, of all time, started in like 1980, is as we saw the arrival of this the series, the what do you
franchise.
Call it? Franchises, yeah. Right. And that's what we have today. And so we saw a number of those during the 1980s, including Raiders of the Lost Ark, Star Wars. You have a list of them, I think, right?
Here are the top grossing films of the 1980s. I'll do the top seven. Number seven, Back to the Future, franchise. Six, Raiders of the Lost Ark, franchise. Five, Batman, franchise. Four, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, franchise. Number three, Return of the Jedi, franchise. Number two, Empire Strikes Back, another franchise. Number one, da-da-da-da, E.T.
Yeah.
Which I'm surprised they didn't make any sequel to.
Right, right. But that changed the way the business ran entirely. And so that what that meant was is that all of a sudden we had formulas. And to my in my particular opinion, I think that killed a lot of great artwork. Because, you know, you no longer... I mean, for me, I don't even go to a lot of movies today because you already know the ending. It's like watching a basketball game for 10 times in a row. You know that there, you know, in any of the CGI things, you're going to have, you know, asphalt gets pushed up into a pile, a corner of a building gets knocked off, a school bus is hanging on the precipice of falling over a bridge or something like that. I don't find that interesting. Yeah. I just know it's, you know, the creativity there is in the CGI and the intent to figure out what clever ways to get to the end.
Many people believe that the 1970s were the golden age of, independent film. I mean, you've got Robert Altman and Hal Ashby, and you've got everything from Chinatown to McCabe and Mrs. Miller, just movies that stand the test of time.
Yeah.
And all that went away. And I think a lot of it had to do with the movie Heaven's Gate, because that was such
a colossal flop,
and it was so expensive. And after that, the studio seemed to take over and say, We're gonna play it safe.
But that was after a couple of guys did some incredible things. I mean, if you look at Francis Ford Coppola's, you know, The Godfather series, right? Some of the best films ever made.
Yep.
And then you also had Raging Bull. You had Scorsese. You know, yeah. Scorsese made these tremendous pictures. And so, you know, there was kind of a return of the auteur for a period of time there that came out of that independent film period.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Heaven's Gate, it went to their heads. They spent $200 million on it. And this was, like, what, $1979, $1980? Ishtar, another one, huge flop. Tremendous amount of money spent on these things. And they just fell apart.
But in your mind, Bill,
Apocalypse Now, that was the other one.
Yeah. Were the movies of the 1980s as good as the movies of the 1970s? Or did the studio system kill a lot of great filmmaking?
I think they killed a lot of great filmmaking, honestly. Mm. But I wouldn't say necessarily that they were all better. But it tends to where you look. Like Cinema Paradiso, you remember that?
Yeah.
Italian film.
Lovely
fantastic.
Movie.
One of
lovely.
The best films around.
Yep.
And so it kind of depends on where you look. Like to this day, I tend to really enjoy French films. And the reason being is that 90 to 95% of all the world's entertainment comes out of Los Angeles or comes out of the United States, right? But we can afford to do blockbusters. We can afford to hire a crew of people in South Korea to do all the animation for an animated film or editors in India to change and put... abdominal muscles on the guys in 300, right?
Yeah.
But French films and other countries with smaller budgets can't do that. So they have to go back to the original idea of storytelling, which was antagonists, protagonists, and an issue, a conflict that needs to be resolved. And I find those to be much more interesting because they're not, you don't know. I mean, you don't know how it's going to resolve.
So as a working actor in the 80s, how did the shift affect you and other actors?
Well, if you remember, in the 1960s and the 1970s, many Hollywood players, if you will, you know, because there was part of a studio system, if their film careers weren't working out, they went to television.
Yep.
And that was almost taboo, though. Like, if you just resigned yourself to going to television, it meant because you really weren't going to have a film career after that. But John Travolta broke that mold with Welcome Back, Kotter, and then coming out with Saturday Night Fever. He broke that mold, and all of a sudden, people could make a leap because now they had this widespread appeal on television, and they became movie actors.
A friend of mine was a writer on Welcome Back, Kotter, and he tells the story that nobody had any idea what this movie was going to be about, and they saw the poster, and they saw John Travolta in the dancing outfit, and they were laughing and making fun of him, like, yeah. Oh, my God, how yeah. embarrassing. And right. then he showed the world.
Right, right, right. So what happened then with actors is the studio system basically let go of all their contract players. I mean, there were still some that had them. My friend Jim Reed still had a contract, I think, with Universal or somebody like that. Maybe it was Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers, I think. But it changed, it transitioned, and suddenly now getting into television was a real stepping stone towards getting a movie career. Yeah. The other thing that happened is that in the 1970s is the horror films all of a sudden became really popular because they made a lot of money and they weren't expensive to make. And so, you know, there was a lot of B-movies, and some of us, like I did Christine, I was like, I don't know if I want to do this.
But now here's a counterpoint coming on the Stolberg line. What the blockbuster franchise films of the 1980s did was hook a whole new generation into going to movie theaters like never before.
I don't know.
It was a trade-off.
They also left a whole lot of people behind. I'm not so sure that's true. In the older days, families, adults, people of all ages went to the movies. And what you ended up finding was is that younger people now frequent the movies at a much larger share yeah. than does the older crowd.
Well, and that's why the studios target the young people.
Yes.
They don't care about people our age.
Right.
What's going to bring the young people in?
Right.
Well, and the other factor, I jotted down the whole idea starting the 80s, late 70s, cross-merchandising.
Yes.
Indiana Jones figurines, yes. Indiana Jones t-shirts. It yes. wasn't enough to release a movie. You had to have all the merchandising.
Right. And that actually helped make a lot of films profitable. So it was an essential component. It no longer seemed to be like just, you know, some frivolity. It actually said, like, okay, well, look, we can do this. We can market these dolls, these clothes, these da-da-da-da. And before that, that really wasn't a thing.
And George Lucas held on to merchandising rights for Star Wars.
Did he really?
Yeah, pretty shrewd.
How much money did he make over that?
I have no idea. Well, he's a gazillionaire.
Yeah, right.
And it all comes from that. But again, at the time, nobody knew what Star Wars was going to be.
Right.
And he said, I want the merchandising rights. And nobody was doing merchandising at that point.
Right, right, right. Well, there's been several times in history where people have made these rather crafty decisions. You know, in 1915, Charlie Chaplin and Clara Bow made that decision to hold on to their profits from and formed the company United Artists, yeah. and it made them millionaires. Oh, Mary Pickford, not Mary Pickford. Clara Bow, Mary Pickford. And they were making millions of dollars in 1915.
It's the classic quote from William Goldman in Hollywood, nobody knows anything.
Yes.
You can't predict. Nobody knows what's going to be a hit, what's going to be a flop.
Right.
Any of that stuff.
So all you try to do is to use whatever that algorithm was in the last picture, they try to take pieces of that as much as they can and put it on top of whatever they're trying to produce today.
All right. We are in conversation with Bill Ostrander, looking back on his days in Hollywood during the 1980s and focusing on Hollywood of the 1980s and how much that decade changed and shaped everything that we see today as we count down to the Academy Awards Sunday night. Off we go. We've got news and traffic and weather, more stories, and we want to talk about favorite movies of the 1980s as well. There's a whole list. You're listening to Hometown. Thanks for joining us on this Monday afternoon. Dave Congleton with you. Bill Ostrander is with us, looking back on his acting days as we get ready for the Academy Awards. The topic is Hollywood in the 80s. Bill, special shout-out?
Yes, I'd like to give a special shout-out to my grandkids, Annie, Kate, and Porter, who are listening down in Dana Point today. I love you guys and wish you were coming this weekend, but hope to see you soon.
Have they seen Christine?
I don't think so. Okay. I'm not sure it's quite appropriate for them.
How old are they?
9, 8, and 6.
Yeah, now they got to wait.
Yeah.
All right, let's put Jim Richards on the spot. Jim, Give us some of your favorite movies from the 1980s.
Well, I like Christine.
Yeah.
Actually, John Carpenter, the director on that, too. We didn't mention that, right?
Right.
Yes, great
thank
movie.
You. Yeah,
great
the movie. Thing. The Thing actually finds itself in the top 100 movies oftentimes in the critics list.
Yeah, and Stephen King, wasn't he the...
It was based on his book.
Based on his book, okay. Another movie Stephen King had something to do with, Stand By Me. I love nice that movie. It's great a great movie.
Also based on one of his novels, Rob Reiner.
Rob Reiner,
and of course a bunch of...
Give us three. So we got Stand By Me, we got Christine.
I have to go with Craig's favorites, The Back to the Future. I like the Back to the Future stuff.
Yeah.
I love that. Stand By Me, Richard Dreyfuss, Will Wheaton, River Phoenix,
Kiefer Sutherland.
Jerry O'Connell. Sorry, the other Rob Reiner classic during that era was The Princess Bride.
You know,
one of the my favorite movies. I really loved that. You didn't like it?
I loved it when it came out, and I watched it again a couple months ago, and I love a lot about it. But some of it just doesn't hold up for me.
Really,
Mandy Patinkin, the music.
Huh.
I don't know. That little Sean, the Wallace Shawn after a while. Just, I don't know.
I think, and of course, you know, Rob Reiner went from being Meathead on All in the Family to being this big time director.
Yeah. I mean, it was
great. A lot of his great stuff came out in the 80s. You have a James Cameron story you want to share?
Sure. Everybody probably knows James Cameron from Aliens first, right? And then he did The Terminator, and then he did Titanic and Avatar, all those kind of things. Great guy. Very smart guy. I was auditioning. I auditioned for him in 1981 for one of his first movies. The first movie he was going to direct, it was Piranha 2.
Piranha 2?
Yeah. Real highbrow material, right? And I didn't get it, but I ended up going to Europe about 2 weeks after that. And I was walking down the street in Rome in the evening and looked into the window of a cafe, and there was James Cameron there sitting there working. He had gone to Rome because Rome was quite a big production place for productions in those days. And he was there doing the artwork or the special effects for Piranha. So I went in and sat down with James and had a nice conversation with him. And then, you know, we ran into each other a few more times. Then he brought me into the Terminator because he had an interest in me playing one of the two leads in Terminator. So, you know, didn't quite get it, unfortunately. That would have been a legacy film.
How does that feel when you come close to getting a role like that? And you're like, does that stay with you? Like, geez, that could have been my role.
There are a few times in my life where I wish that I would have spoken up. That was just kind of a novelty, but I didn't really feel like I was close enough to really go, ah.
And how would you have spoken up in one of these? What could you have spoken up to say?
So I was called by Barbara Hershey. Do you remember Barbara Hershey?
I love Barbara Hershey. I had a major crush on her.
Well, I was the West Coast selection to do a Broadway reprisal of On the Waterfront, and I was going to play Terry Malloy.
Oh.
And so Daniel Mann was the director for that, and Barbara Hershey called him and asked him if he knew of somebody who could work with her for her audition for Martin Scorsese for The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah.
So, you know, I agreed and I started working with Barbara on that. And then we went in and we auditioned for Martin in the Westwood Marquee Hotel in Westwood. And he told me I did a great job, but the audition was for her. So out of deference, I didn't really stand up. You know, I didn't say anything. But I regret to this day that I didn't say, hey, you know, this is her audition, but what about me? You know, could I have a chance at this too? You know, so there are a few times like that where I made a mistake. Also, a film that I know you like, Mulholland Drive.
Oh, I love Mulholland Drive. Well, you were in that.
I was in that just for a brief second. And
you're still in it.
I'm still in it, yeah. And I wish that I would have said something to David Lynch also. Because,
what would you have said?
Well, he was... There
when
was
you said, what the hell's this movie about anyway?
Yes, I think that's fair. But I think it was... David didn't cast things in a normal way. David didn't, you know, have like open readings and people come in and do readings for him. He met people and then he sat down and he talked to them for a while. And I had this opportunity to have a conversation with him, but I was a little hesitant in the moment, in the circumstance that I was in, and I didn't assert myself, and I wish I would have. There's a few times like that where I wish I would have.
On the Stolberg text line, JQ Chicks and Hey JQ, 1982 was the best year ever for sci-fi fantasy. E.T., Blade Runner, and The Thing all coming out in the same month of June. Others include Road Warrior, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, Poltergeist, and Conan. This guy knows science fiction fantasy.
Yeah. Well, a few stories there if you want to hear sure. them. I was dating a woman who was best friends with Daryl Hannah. And Daryl Hannah and Hillary and I and Rutger Hauer all went out to dinner one night during the time when they were shooting that. Now, if you remember Rutger Hauer, Ned, he had bleached white hair.
In Blade Runner.
Yeah. And he had just brilliant blue eyes. And he was just an unusual guy. He was very big boned. His forearms were huge, right? And he came to dinner wearing black leather pants and a knit sweater that had a tiger from the right hip all the way up over to the left shoulder. So here's this guy, this cyborg, dressing like this with this giant tiger on his shirt. And we go to dinner. And Brian Doyle Murray was there, Bill Murray's brother stuff. And we were talking. We said, you know, the lady comes around to take our drink order. And she says, you know, would you like a drink, Rutger? And he says, no, I can't. And so, you know, everybody at the table is like, well, come on, Rutger, have a drink. And he's like, no, I can't. And he said that to him like two or three times. And finally they said, why not? Why can't you have a drink? And he goes, because I might kill somebody. Everybody there, the hair stood up in the back of their neck. But what he really meant was he was driving.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to kill somebody from being drunk. But in that moment, we're like, oh my God, leave the guy alone.
Scott's in San Luis. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Dave. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, Scott.
Good to hear from you, Bill. You know,
thank you.
I'm a film guy. And I like cinematography. And, you know, 80s was, you know, cinematography. Today we have digital. You know, the cost of film is, you know, it's 24 frames a second. You know, between buying the film, shooting the film, and then developing it, and then go to Telecine process, it's roughly about $100 to $200 an hour where you send it to a lab. That's the reason why they've gotten off film. But I still admire directors shooting in film. And so,
Hang on a second. What do you think about that, film versus digital?
Well, digital is getting so much better, and any way we can keep the expense down in the film is good. But film is beautiful, and there's a great story by Nestor Almendros. Do you remember Nestor Almendros,
no.
Scott? Almendros was a Cuban-born cinematographer who did Days of Heaven. You remember Days of Heaven with Richard Gere? The whole movie was shot in the last 2 hours of what they call golden time or golden hour, right? Yeah. And there's a great scene in there where these locusts are swarming a field. Do you remember that scene by any chance? Well, there's a whole bunch of locusts that are swarming this field where they obviously couldn't release, you know, a billion locusts out in the middle of this wheat field. So what they did was, they had these actors that were supposed to be in the middle of the field. Nestor Almendros, they hired a helicopter and filled it with peanuts. And then they had all the actors take their final positions and then walk backwards. And the helicopter flew over out of camera frame, obviously, and dropped these peanuts onto the ground. And so when they played the film in forward, it showed the peanuts jumping up, which looked like insects. And all the actors are now walking forward. And I love that about film. You know, film is creative, not just because of, you know, the acting or the writing, but actually how you get those images.
What else, Scott?
You know, I was looking at the history of when film peaked, like Best Picture, and it seems like Hollywood peaked for Best Picture in the 60s and the 70s, and I thought it would be, you know, 60s to the 80s. But when I'm looking at, like, Best Picture, these nominees like American Fiction, Barbie, Hangover, Past Lives, Poor Things, I've seen some of these films, and I just was not impressed. You know, I like
Fiction is a great movie. Have you seen it? This is one of the great movies of the year, and I think that Cord Jefferson is going to win the Oscar for best screenplay.
Well, there's one thing that Lou Ferrigno, he came in about a month ago, and he said something that made a lot of sense. Was, you know, going back to organic films, because like Marvel is so much CGI that it's so overwhelming. I think people are losing touch.
Yeah.
And I like to go back to, you know, organic films.
Is too much CGI, Bill?
Oh, way too much CGI for my taste. And I think that'll blow over at some point. But, you know, I'm interested that both you and Scott here are talking about the golden era of film. Yeah. But I think if you look at any film historian, they'll tell you that the golden era of film was 1939.
Well, yes, in that was the year that you had Gone with the Wind, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It's like the best film nominees that year blow your mind.
Yeah, also,
but I'm just talking about over the course of a decade.
Yeah.
I mean, 1939 is a single year.
The Wizard of Oz was also 1939.
Right, which I've never seen.
You've never seen The Wizard of Oz?
I know, don't go there.
Do you know that The Wizard of Oz the Rhett Butler, Gone with the Wind, had the same director?
Michael Curtiz?
No, Frank Baum.
Frank Baum. Well, Frank Baum wrote Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
All right, Scott, thank you. I've got issues. Carol, your grandchildren are listening. I'm sorry, grandkids. On the Stolberg line, Carol checks in. Hey, Carol, my favorite movie of the 1980s is Out of Africa with Meryl Streep and Robert Redford.
Great film.
Wonderful film.
Yeah.
But I kept wanting Meryl Streep and Sean Connery. I never bought Robert Redford with a British accent. I wanted Sean Connery, but
yeah. Well, you know, that's an interesting piece, because if you know anything about Robert Redford, that was a period of time when he was going through a divorce. And the story was about a guy who was unwilling to make that sort of formal commitment. Mm-hmm. And I thought there's kind of an interesting
Rob
parallel.
Checks in. Hey, Rob, one of my favorite 1980s movies is Streets of Fire, directed by Walter Hill.
Mm.
You got, what are your, give me a couple of favorites of yours.
Oh, a couple of favorites of mine. Raging Bull.
Yeah.
Maybe one of my all-time favorites. I mean, I can watch that over and over and over again. De Niro was absolutely brilliant in that. Amadeus, loved Amadeus, you know. That producer, Saul Zentz, is one of my favorite producers of all time. You know, and then there were other films that were fun that, you know, you kind of throw in there just because, you know, Caddyshack. Great, funny film, right?
Yeah.
You know, it was Elephant Man, one of my favorite films from back in those days. Do you remember Elephant Man?
Yes, David Lynch.
Yes. You know, Spinal Tap.
Launched the mockumentary format.
Right. Road Warrior came out during that time. You know, Raising Arizona, the Coen brothers really made a leap to the mainstream in the 80s with Raising Arizona. Are you a fan of that?
Absolutely. I love the Coen brothers comedies. I had seen Blood Simple, and I didn't know if I was on board with the Coen brothers or not, because it was kind of violent.
Yeah.
Then I saw Raising Arizona. Yeah. It's like, wow, that's hilarious.
When I read the script for that, I thought the first 72 pages of that was the best screenplay I'd ever read.
Then what happened on page 73?
I didn't like how the film resolved, where the furniture guy suddenly sort of like forgives them, and they do give the baby back. And
I totally agree. I didn't like the ending.
Yeah, it just didn't work. But I loved the movie up to that. I thought it was hysterical, and Nick Cage was fantastic.
Can you guess my favorite movie of the 1980s?
Blue Velvet?
Yes.
Did
ding,
I do
ding,
it?
Ding, ding, yes. Exactly. Man, Bill Ostrander.
Yeah.
I love Blue Velvet.
Yeah. Was Isabella Rossellini in that?
Yes. Oh, yeah, yes. Oliver.
Yeah, Oliver. That's right.
Yes. I was just reading about that, is that in my mind, Dennis Hopper, as Frank Booth, gives the best supporting actor role I have ever seen.
Really?
Ever.
Yeah.
And he didn't get nominated. He got nominated instead for Hoosiers. Mm. They came out the same year because old Hollywood was afraid to honor that role. Oh, I love Blue Velvet.
I think that's one of the things that you could say that aren't right about the award seasons.
Yeah.
They tend to award just the top films, the top studio films, and they tend to be, you know, like Sophie's Choice type of films, typically. Yeah. But you know what I saw the other night is Something's Gotta Give with Jack Nicholson and Diane Keaton.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yes.
Diane Keaton gives a masterclass in acting in this thing. But she will never get an award for it, unfortunately, and she deserves one. That was a fantastic performance she gave there. I was in awe.
The other two I would just throw out, I'm always a big fan of Witness with Harrison Ford.
Okay.
I just thought that was the perfect film. And then I just screened this the other day for a friend of mine, Local Hero. the British Scottish film.
Yeah.
Peter Riegert, yeah. Burt Lancaster. Yeah. I've seen that like 35 times.
Well,
never Wizard of Oz, but local hero 35 times.
Scarface. How about that?
Too violent for me.
Too violent for you. You know that Christine had more curse words and used more language in that, I think, probably since Scarface or very close to the same.
Carol's texting back. I just watched Sean Connery in The Untouchables last night. He was amazing. He won Best Supporting Actor. Mm. I like that movie, too, but again, it's very violent.
Mm.
Anyway, Bill Ostrander's here. We're just talking about Hollywood in the 80s. We'll come back for a final segment right here on KVEC. Where Carol is texting in to say she just watched Witness last night. What are the odds? I must have told you previously that Blue Velvet's my favorite movie.
No, I knew that you were a huge Dave Lynch fan, so I just took a guess.
Of Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive, yes. Most of David Lynch goes right over my head.
Yeah, well,
but those two.
I took a guess. I mean, it really was a guess, but I thought it was because you liked David Lynch.
What was it like on his set?
He is one of the rare auteurs of film.
Yep.
And what I mean by that, for those of you who have never made film, is that typically a film set for a major film, there are probably 200 people that are on set, and then there are any number of different people that follow in post-production. And when somebody has a vision like David Lynch does and is able to see that through all the way to the end, it's an exceedingly rare talent. There's a handful of guys that can do like that. Woody Allen, for better or for worse, is able to do that. He keeps he keeps that same ambiance, that mood, that story, the way he tells a story all the way through to the end. David Lynch is one of those people. So when David Lynch said something, you know, everybody jumps because they don't know exactly where he's going, but they know that they're going to trust him and follow him.
I don't want to debate Woody Allen, but I do think that Zelig remains a masterpiece.
Yeah. Well, Crimes and Misdemeanors, too.
And Hannah and Her Sisters.
Oh, there's some great stuff.
I don't apologize for Woody Allen.
Yeah.
But Zelig is unlike, I can't compare it to any other movie.
Yeah.
How do you compare that?
Yeah.
What mind comes up with that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
We got a couple minutes left, Mr. Ostrander. Where's Hollywood going?
I don't know. That's a really interesting question because I think it's trying to reinvent itself right now. You know, all the streaming and the network stuff is new. I mean, and nobody knows exactly where it's going. I think right now there's an awful lot of effort going into inclusion. A client of mine actually was one of the people responsible at Disney for helping him to see that right now, she said that 70% of all the grandchildren in the country are of mixed race or of minority.
76%.
70%.
70%.
70% of all the grandchildren today. And so she was talking about how important that is for inclusion. So we've seen a lot of work going into inclusion. We've seen, last year there was over 600 television series produced. So Hollywood right now is in a drawback period where we're trying to figure out where to spend money and how much money to spend in order to be profitable. So there's a lot of retrenching going on right now.
Ingrid on the Stolberg text line wants to make a case for Labyrinth, 1986. Broke open the seduction of temptation for teenage girls with David Bowie and Jennifer Connelly.
Never saw it.
I've never even heard of it.
Yeah.
David Bowie and Jennifer Connelly.
Odd pairing.
Streaming, more and more people just watching movies at home.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's a good thing. I think going to the theater is kind of nice. So you have a shared experience with your community and you see something that's larger than life. Just putting it on television, I don't know, it's less investment in that.
Yeah, but when you go to the Regal and Aurora Grande and they make you wait a half hour through commercials.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah, they're chasing it out.
Yeah.
We end with Francine. Ghostbusters, Tootsie, Airplane. Oh, yeah, I love Airplane.
Oh, yeah.
The Shining, Aliens, and Full Metal Jacket, all good choices.
Yep.
Always a good choice to have Mr. Bill Ostrander on the show. I'm going to give him 45 seconds for a final thought, sir.
Boy, you put me on the spot quick.
Wait a minute. Every time you come in here, you get a final thought.
Well, you, because you said
you got 30 seconds.
You wound it up, and I thought, okay, well, we're out. You know, bottom line is there were tremendous movies, and I am a huge fan of movies that are about character and about subjective experiences. I think we learn something from that. I think we grow. I know that there's a huge fan base out there for the Marvel movies and all that stuff, the DC Comics. I'm not one of them. They all are the same to me. They all look. You know, I think, you know, what's his name? Scorsese got a lot of grief for that, saying that.
But he's right. It's not movies.
Yeah, it's just not the same. If you grew up in those days when you could go back into a theater and you watch people go through life and you learn something, that's a transportive experience.
All right, Bill, thank you very much. Appreciate the effort.
Thanks for having me.
Off we go. News, traffic, weather. Up next, we feature our conversation with the sheriff of Riverside County, Chad Bianco. We think he's running for governor. Stay with us.
The 920 KBEC Podcast Network is presented by the Slo County Real Estate Podcast with Hal Swayze. Up-to-date information on the local real estate market on your time. New episodes weekly at the podcast link at 920kbec.com and wherever you get your podcasts. California DRE 0111-911.